Hello, and welcome to another episode of Endeavors. On today's show, actor Yannick Besson. That's coming up on Endeavors. Indecision keeps me up now. Need another place to mind. Give a little bit of God to sin. Keeping safe is keeping you away now. I don't know what you mean by that. I don't know what you mean now. Murdoch Mysteries. There are few shows in television history, and especially in the pantheon of Canadian media, that have been as enduring and long-lasting as Murdoch. Now, in its 13th season, the show is 4 episodes away from completing 200. The star of that show is Yannick Besson. But although he is most well-known as Detective William Murdoch, he has also appeared as a regular in a few other TV shows, including Sue Thomas FBI, the animated comedy The Adventures of Napkin Man, Nothing Too Good for a Cowboy, and Learning the Ropes. He has also guest starred on Hockey Night, Street Legal, Young at Heart, Genius, Relic Hunter, Mutant X, Missing, Kevin Hill, Falcon Beach, The Dresden Files, Flashpoint, The Listener, Republic of Doyle, which featured a crossover between him and Alan Hocko, playing descendants and ascendants of their character respectively, Royal Canadian Air Farce, and This Hour Has 22 Minutes. He has also appeared on film in Toby McTeague, My Pet Monster, Casino Jack, the hilarious Another Wolf Cop, and the upcoming Helmington. For his work as Detective William Murdoch, he has been nominated for an Actor Award for Outstanding Performance, has directed 5 episodes, and was recently awarded the ACTRA Lifetime Achievement Award. The show has featured guest stars from everybody to William Shatner, Stephen Harper, Ed Asner, Brendan Coyle, Peter Mansbridge, Oliver Mowat, Arlene Dickinson, Alan Hocko, Colin Mochrie, and you'll hear about a very special guest appearing on the show this season. And also, prior to being a show, William Murdoch was featured in 3 TV movies that starred Peter Outerbridge. Helmington was released last week, and he's also in another upcoming film called A Perfect Plan. This is my conversation with Yannick Besson. Yannick Besson, hello, good afternoon. Thanks for being here today.
It's my pleasure.
So you're part of an interesting new horror film called Helmington. How did you become a part of this project?
Well, one of the things that I'm always looking, searching for is stuff that's, you know, radically different from my day job. I do Murdoch Mysteries. We're on season 13, just launched last night. And that's a very specific character. I've kind of painted him into a little bit of a box. He's a very straight-laced sort of guy. So I'm always looking for opportunities that take me in a very different direction. And having been involved with the guys at Cineco and Jay Jolly and a bunch of other producers, Bill Marks, you know, those guys have always told them, hey, if you have anything coming up, please, please, please give me a shot. And I got the call from Bill. He said, listen, I'm shooting this. We're putting it all together. And the guys would, and I mean the director consortium would like to have you. And it was so intriguing, the concept of it and sort of the role that I'd be playing was so intriguing that I jumped.
Would you consider yourself a fan of horror?
I've never really been one. I do like the application, and I do like when it's done well. And I'm always amazed at how somebody can always find a new twist on it. You know, when oh gosh, forgive me, I'm forgetting the name of it, but when they did that sort of, you're gonna have to erase my. Erase my huge pause here, but was one where they were all in the woods and it was like all point of view shot. And,
Blair Witch Project?
Yeah, you know what I mean? Like, it's always like, wow, somebody has come up with a new way to scare the shit out of people. And I'm just like always amazed. You know, sci-fi, it's like, okay, well, there's another parallel universe. Oh, okay, there's another time warp, or there's another alternate alien sort of thing. But, you know, how do you scare people? You know, now, you know, we're so many years on in that genre, and I find it super innovative, and I thought this one was pretty cool.
You know, it's interesting that you mentioned that, because I've always felt, especially lately, we're seeing horror films really tackle some important social issues or have some sort of social commentary. What do you think it is about the horror genre that can do that effectively as opposed to a straight drama or a straight comedy or a sci-fi film?
Well, one of the things that, you know, going up in the 70s and 80s, there was always the sexy woman victim, the hapless sexy woman victim who just ran and ran and ran, and eventually the film would sum itself up. But now you've got these strong characters, these strong women that are in the leads of stuff like, was it Silence, and all these different movies that, you know, are breaking new ground, I think, by having that female, that strong female character, in often case the a matriarch and so on. I think it's bolstered the genre and made it better.
How, you know, you mentioned you look for projects that are different, but how would you compare Detective Murdoch to Professor Freeborn?
I'd say the Professor has had a lot of things happen to him in life. I think he was somewhat disgraced. He allowed some, you know, personal... what would you call them, caprices, sort of ruin his life. And so he's just dangling out there in near non-existence until somebody has to pick his brain for something that, you know, might help the clue trail. And I tried to make him that way. I tried to make him like somebody who had, you know, maybe thought with his pants before thinking with his head, and, you know, has got disgraced out of school, and then he has some weird, quirky sort of, you know, dressing habits and things that, you know, a guy wouldn't necessarily notice on his own if he didn't have a woman, a loving woman telling him, hey man, you can't put that sweater with that shirt. So he's kind of living this lonely existence and somewhat in not gulag, but, you know, he's out there on his own.
One of the things that intrigues me about this film is you get to work with a Canadian icon of the genre, Michael Ironside. Whenever I, you know, read about him in a horror film, it always says, you know, he's one of the kings of those types of movies. Did you?
Oh my God, yeah.
What was your experience like working with him in this capacity?
Well, I'll take you back to, like, say, 1983, 1984. I used to go to this this little acting class, and it would also, that office would often double as actually a casting office. They would run auditions out of there. And here I was, this 14-year-old kid, and there was a poster of Scanners on the wall. And I had seen the trailer. That was all I was allowed to see at that age. I'd seen the trailer, and you know, I was immediately aware of him and his being on the scene and at the top of the game from a young age. So it was kind of cool to run into him on this project. I thought, hey, wow, I finally sort of made it to this point in my career that I wanted to get to at some age.
It's interesting you mentioned that. I mean, because you've had a very successful TV show for 13 years. You were on another very popular show before that, Sue Thomas. You know, you've done an animated show. But was there a specific time in your career where you thought, gee, I've really made it? Like you mentioned, working with Michael was a big highlight.
I don't know. I think it's the nature of a lot of us as performers to doubt and to be somewhat fearful, because you've been fired, or I wouldn't say fired, but you know, jobs have ended unceremoniously so many times throughout my career. I've been involved with 6 or 8 different series, and you know, they have their run, which is, you know, either by demand, you know, up to 4 years, or by lack of demand, less than that, or you know, there's a million and one things that can assail a project. So you're always thinking, okay, well, it's going to end any minute. And then you're also thinking, oh God, will I ever work again? So for me to let my brain go to, wow, that, you know, I really made it. Here I am, this. I don't think I've ever really had that moment. I've had some pretty serious highlights where I thought, wow, this is incredible. I was in Cannes during MIPCON 1 year. It was toward the beginning of Murdoch, and got in a taxi to get down to the convention area, and the guy in the front seat looked in his rearview mirror, and all of a sudden I see what I thought was terror in his eyes. So I looked behind us to see what he was looking at in the rearview mirror. It turns out he recognized me. He says, Inspector Murdoch, dans mon taxi, wow! He was like... You know, here I am in Europe, in France, and this guy recognized me. I was kind of blown away, and I did not expect it at all. My wife and I had a good chuckle. And a similar experience happened to me in Italy. I was in this old world restaurant near Rome, and this young waiter comes up from down in the wine cellar, and he pops up and he goes, Detective Murdoch! And it was a bit of a shock.
You know, you mentioned Murdoch, and we talked about the very fluid nature of television in the business. But 13 years is a lifetime in television, especially Canadian television.
Oh my God! Yeah, it's what? Uncharted territory in any country television wise. There are very few. It's rare air. There are very few shows that go to that amount of years. And beyond.
What do you attribute its success, and why is the show and the role and the character still appealing to you after all this time?
Well, the what makes it appealing, I think, is the writing. I mean, it's so cleverly written, and you know, they never really, you know, we have history on our side. They never really run out of ideas and historical characters and references and events. So, you know, we have that on our side. But I think that the key ingredient is that we also don't take ourselves too seriously. You know, we do have some fun. We do keep it light a certain percent of the time. And that keeps it fun for us. I think it keeps it fresh for the audience as well. We've had some offbeat episode, but you know, we've taken some criticism for, but you know, at the same time, we're almost at 200 1 hour episodes. We got to do some stuff for us, for our own artistic satisfaction as well, and I think that's what is the key ingredient. I mean, a lot of people will point to different things. Any one person that you speak to that's a fan of the show will say, you know, I love the romance, I love the intrigue, I love the solving the mystery, I like the historical characters, I like the locations, I like the inventions. Everybody's different. But I still think the fact that we can sort of tread that line where we do have some fun is the most important.
You know, you're coming up to the 200th episode, which is a pretty big milestone. Is there going to be how do you approach something like that?
Well, there were a lot of ideas batted around. We had, you know, anything from a musical episode to like a live episode to, you know, you start thinking of what other shows that came before you that had milestones, what they did, or, you know, just what's been successful. And one of the things that really set the tone of this show, I think, was the science of it, the sort of pre-CSI, the birth of CSI aspect of it, which was a sort of a linchpin of the show. And my sense is that we will probably focus on that more than anything for the 200th. I mean, we've got a lot of inventions, inventors, and people that, you know, change the course of history to pull from. So my sense is that that's going to be the focus for the 200th.
You had the former prime minister on, and you've had a few other politicians and non-acting guest stars. Any word on if Trudeau will make a guest appearance?
I don't know. I know I think he was a drama teacher at a certain point, so I think he's aware of this world. So who knows? I mean, Prime Minister, former Prime Minister Harper was a fan of the show, and he made that known to us. And he reached out to us, so that was the driving force there. So we're like, well, hey, let's you know, collaborate on something together. And he actually wrote a script and did a whole bunch of the historical research on you know, the history of our National Hockey League. And so we incorporated a bunch of that into another story that he inspired. So it was very much driven by him. Now, whether our current prime minister has any time on his hands coming up, who knows?
You've had a lot of guest stars over the year. I know Colin Mochrie made a joke in 2017 that he was the only person who hadn't done a spot. But is there one actor that hasn't appeared on the show that you would love to work with?
Well, actually, this season that happened. There was Colm Feore, who is one of the greatest actors of our time. I've worked with on a couple of occasions. He's always, you know, been an icon, certainly in our industry and abroad, and you know, a resident of Stratford, probably the most respected, you know, concentration of actors in the world. And so I actually ran into him through a mutual acquaintance out closer to where he lives. I was dropping off a car. I was doing a car deal. My wife's car lease ended. So anyway, we're on the phone with the salesperson. He goes, oh man, you wouldn't believe who I've got in my car for a test drive right now. You must know him, Colm Feore. You guys must know each other. I said, keep him there. I'm going to be there in 10 minutes. And so of course I run into Colm, and Colm says, what are you up to? I said, actually, I'm directing an episode. He goes, oh yeah, that show of yours. I must be the only Canadian actor who's never been on it. In fact, you guys talk all the time about how you've had so many Canadian icons. I said, Colm, have I got a job for you? And I right there on the spot, I cast him in the episode I directed at the very first episode of season 13.
Directing yourself as an actor always has its challenges. How do you balance wearing those two hats?
Well, I'm always wearing many hats. Having been involved with the show, I sort of feel, I'm an executive producer now, so I feel like I on the floor, I'm you know, performing, I'm observing, you know, quality control, for lack of a better term. So, I take it very seriously. And I also really enjoy directing, so that part is really easy. The hard part is performing while I'm doing that. I sort of feel like that part suffers a little bit because, you know, your brain is scattered. Murdoch's a character that's very, you know, has to speak precisely, exactly. You know, you can't sort of hem and haw your dialogue. So that part is difficult. And I'll often be in a scene with another actor, and they're doing their lines and they're performing, and I'm thinking, oh, I'm going to have to do this, I'm going to have to adjust that, and I'm thinking more along the lines of this. So they must look at me sometimes and my eyes are just glazed over while they're performing with me, and my mind's somewhere else entirely. So I do feel bad for that. We have, you know, technology now. I have digital playback that's available while I'm directing. Otherwise, we wouldn't have it. It's just not necessary. But I'll, you know, reference stuff like that for technical aspects that I want to double check on. Most of the time, you know, I've been doing this for 35 years. I'm pretty aware if my performance was where I wanted it to be. And then it's just, you know, referencing technical so I can stitch it all together seamlessly when I edit. And it goes pretty well.
Have you ever thought about or had desires to direct a feature?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. That's always on my mind. And as a matter of fact, at any given time where, you know, I have a lot of acquaintances and a lot of different people, and we're circulating around ideas and developing scripts, and some of them would be an acting vehicle for me, some of them would be directing or both, and or nothing at all, just producing. And yeah, absolutely. I mean, it would be the ultimate luxury for me to be able to direct something and not act in it and be 100% objective in that regard. You know, I really wish I could. So that shouldn't be on the line, I don't think.
So in the 13 years of doing this show, is there one or two memories that stick out for you that were fun or odd or...
Oh, absolutely. I did a really terrific episode called What Lies Buried. And our principal guest on that was Nigel Bennett, who's also an incredible alumni actor. And we did in one month, I think it was a Monday morning, we did 15 pages, the two of us. And it was all super intense interrogation and revealing layers of history and different things and uncovering crime. And that was a really incredible accomplishment for me. I always keep pieces of those scenes on my actor reel because I feel like especially proud of that. And then, you know, there's, of course, my babies. Some of the episodes that I've directed had very strong themes. I did a sort of a zombie episode one time. So you can imagine, you know, how much fun that was to play with that genre. And I just absolutely loved it, and I think it came off incredibly well. We also I had the opportunity to direct a Western-type episode where we had Masterson on the trail of Butch Cassidy and Sundance. And so I threw in all the cliches and the different things that I, you know, cut my teeth on as a kid watching movies, and that was a big highlight. And we had Stephen Ogg as the guest on that. You're probably familiar with Stephen from what's that famous Xbox game where he's just running rampant through Vegas and throwing bodies in cars and all that.
Grand Theft Auto,
I think that's it. Yeah. He was also a principal player on Westworld as well.
I wanted to ask you about the crossover that you did with another great Canadian show, Republic of Doyle. How did that come about? Because that was a very interesting take on a crossover.
Yeah, I think it was really well done on both sides, and it turned out really well. We had some good sort of integration there. I'm not sure what the original idea, who it came from or how, because I was in the middle of shooting, so these things, just all of a sudden it's like, all right, you're on a flight to Newfoundland. So in that particular case, I'm not sure. But I think, you know, it was probably something that evolved from the network and wanting to create a cross promotion. And, you know, and those guys are super talented over there. They were able to, you know, take the idea and run with it. And of course, our writing room did the same. And it fell together pretty easily, I thought. And it was a lot of fun. I was actually talking to Alan yesterday, and we want to, you know, we want to collaborate on something. We got to find something to work on together. And we were just shooting the shit back and forth. And there'll be something. There's going to have to be something.
Speaking of iconic Canadian shows, how did you end up guesting on This Hour?
Oh, I can't remember, but I just got asked. And that was so much fun. And it was kind of funny because they made a lot of assumptions. They said, okay, you're going to spoof this Australian character. So I had to do this stand-up news bit as an Australian guy. And luckily I had a little bit of, you know, schlocky Australian accent in my back pocket, so I was able to pull it off. But they also had me do some Murdoch spoof stuff, and it was a lot of fun. Again, a chance to do something different, flex different muscles, so I jumped at it when they asked.
Do you enjoy comedy?
Yeah, probably most of all. My very first series as a kid, the very first series I did was a show called Learning the Ropes. There was a three-camera sitcom, and it was with George Tricker and Neil Rosen, if I'm getting the names correct. You know, these guys did Welcome Back, Kotter, you know, so I learned, you know, from the best at a very young age. They had done, you know, countless hit shows, and so it was a lot of fun. It was a unique opportunity, and I remember it fondly, and I think it served me well in just about every other genre of showbiz that I've stepped into, because you learn timing, and timing works in every part of an actor's performance, whether it's a dramatic, comedic, or, you know, whatever. It's so important, and I think that's why people like Robin Williams were so successful. You know, he just had it all.
You you know, you mentioned the earlier part of your career, and I know your very first project was a hockey movie, if I'm correct.
Yep.
Hockey Night, and then years later you appeared in sort of a movie that has elements of hockey in another Wolf Cop.
Oh yeah.
which I saw the film. I actually interviewed Lowell a couple years ago. It's hilarious. I love it. But as a Canadian, what does hockey mean to you?
Well, you know, I think if you ask a New Yorker, they're very fond of their baseball and everything else. But I think it's just a core thing that, you know, we were born into it. And, you know, I had family members who played very high level hockey, and I was on the ice when I, you know, could walk. And I don't know, it's just a huge part of our culture. It's something that we all sort of rallied together around. And, you know, it's just iconic. I think personally that hockey athletes are the greatest athletes of all the sports. So, you know, they're gladiators.
I know I asked you earlier about your favorite memory from Murdoch, but do you have a favorite moment that sticks out for you from the shoot of Helmington?
Well, my involvement was pretty short. I had, I believe, all of a day that I was involved with the shoot, because my stuff was all contained. So I quite liked the speech itself. I quite liked the scene itself and the setting. When I stepped in there, it was, and I don't know how much the art department did or how much the place that we went into actually had it already, but I sort of felt like, and similar to Murdoch, you know, I felt like I stepped into this guy's world instantly, and I was so impressed, and I kind of felt felt lucky. It helps to drive your performance if you feel instantly like you're stepping into the world that of this person you're helping to create. And I know that sounds kind of schlocky, but it's true. I mean, it's very practical.
And I know you appear in another film that's currently in post-production with Carlo Rota and William Forsythe and Kathleen Monroe. What can you tell us about A Perfect Plan?
Well, that was fun. It's a bit of a heist movie, and it's all sort of contained, and it has a lot of genre stuff in it. But for my character, I really thought it was cool because he's this sort of mystery man that's operating on behalf of this mystery group. You know, if you could liken it to, the Illuminati or something like that. And it's sort of this shadowy bad guy, maybe, good guy, maybe, we don't know. And so that ambiguity was kind of fun to play off of. And they actually... sort of changed some of my dialogue to have me end up being potentially there if we go another round and do a follow-up to it, which I thought was kind of neat. It just kind of on the fly changed things a little bit, and I thought that made it interesting because then all of a sudden it became open-ended, which was cool.
Do you know, have you heard anything about a release date for that yet?
No, I have not. I have not.
Well,
Bill Marks is a friend of mine. I suppose I should maybe call him and ask him.
I was just going to comment on, Perfect Plan is a, Canadian film. There's you and a couple other Canadians, and Murdoch is iconic Canadian show, and a lot of the projects you do are based here in Canada. What do you make of the state of our industry right now?
Well, it's interesting. You know, the service side of our industry, the infrastructure that we have to service a lot of this foreign production is without a doubt very important. That keeps us relevant, and that keeps a lot of money flowing into the country. In Ontario, we're the second biggest industry. We do more volume dollar-wise than the steel industry, for example, and that's all good. One of the things that is a concern to me, though, is that our regulating bodies, and I think the average person, aren't really aware of the sort of kind of precipice that we're on of, Canadian culture being erased from our airwaves and our screens. We don't have a very strong percentage of the primetime hours available. You know, Murdoch's an exception. We have 24 hours of primetime in any given week, and the average amount of Canadian hours during that 24 hours, you'd be shocked to know, is about half an hour on average per Canadian broadcast distribution undertaking. So it's a little bit scary to think that, pretty soon everything we're going to watch is the same thing that they watch in the U.S. We're the number one consumer of U.S. media. And I think really it's an awareness thing, because if you look at Murdoch, it's successful around the globe. It's in 110 countries. We're number one in a lot of countries that you would not, believe. You know, in Paris on Sunday night, we're the number one watched series. And that's, dubbed into French, which is mind-blowing. So there's an appetite for Canadian creativity, Canadian innovation, and Canadian culture around the world. And we're just not making very much of it because, the broadcasters aren't forced to do so. So, or not as much as I think they should be. So that worries me. And I think it's just, a matter of people knowing. I think if more people knew that, they're paying X amount of dollars for their cable, and oftentimes they're paying twice for the American shows that they watch, because they're getting the American feed as well as watching it on Canadian channels. you know, I can't talk enough about it. I feel like our the CRTC, or the body that's in charge of making sure that this is equal and keeping our industry vibrant, is, you know, sorely lacking in that area.
How much does something like Netflix help, though? Because we're seeing it with a CBC show like Anne with an E, for example, that got an international distribution through Netflix. Are streaming services good for the industry?
Well, they are good in some ways. For instance, Margaret Atwood's book, Handmaid's Tale, that got flatly turned down many times here on our side of the border. And then it got picked up in the U.S., and then it got brought here to be shot. And everybody's calling it a big successful story, but it got turned down here. You know, Anne with an E is a great thing to point to, absolutely. And the volume of stuff that Netflix is doing is fantastic. You're talking about hundreds of millions of dollars of production here, but a lot of it is service industry production. It's not creatives that are Canadian, not that much, and not ideas that are, you know, bolstering our grassroots creativity and our culture here in Canada. You know, some of it is, which I'm really grateful for, and they should keep going. But when the current government rolled out, you know, hey, Netflix is really putting a lot of money, they've committed to putting a lot of money into the entertainment sector here in Canada. Well, they were already committed to doing that. It wasn't anything new, and it wasn't something that they were being held to. It wasn't, you know, something revolutionary or new. It was, well, business as usual. It was just, you know, hey, it's in the hundreds of millions of dollars, so it looks great. It is great. But it would be even better if we were exporting Canadian-created shows and having them be on primetime on our airwaves as well.
Speaking of the Canadian industry, awards are a big part of it all. And I know you received sort of the Lifetime Achievement Award from ACTRA a couple years ago. You know, all awards are unique, but what was the particular meaning of this one for you?
Well, being recognized by your peers is probably the greatest form of you know, acceptance and certainly a reward. You know, you have the audience success, which is the first thing that you want and the most important. But, you know, being recognized by your peers means so much. And I like to feel like I've contributed to, you know, our artistic community here for a long, long time. I've been part of it. I have treated it as something that needs all of us to pay careful attention to and to give our time to. And, you know, I treat every actor that comes on our set the same way. And if there's something that I can impart or teach or give to them that will make their journey better and as a result, the entire industry better, you know, I do it. So, you know, it was great to get a shot in the arm and a kudos for exactly that. And that's what I equate it to. I mean, it's not like I have any, you know, incredible talent that, you know, absolutely must be recognized today type of thing. I think it's, you know, it's reflective of work ethic and you know, team player and being the quarterback on a successful show and making sure everybody gets their fair shake on that show. Crew as well. I treat every technician with a respect that they deserve, because, you know, they, first of all, you never know who they're going to be, A, and B, it didn't take nothing to get to where they are. They're all highly skilled technicians, you know, right down to the people that do the scenic painting. They are artists, and they should be, you know, treated as somebody who does an incredible job, which they do.
Can I ask you quickly about the experience of working with Rick Springfield?
Well, that was life-changing for me. I was always a huge fan, and I learned an incredible amount from him right off the bat. He's a very hardworking guy, has a giant heart. He is a super creative and is constantly creating new things, writing books, you know, recording new music, collaborating with other artists, acting in other TV series, doing completely different roles one from the other. So I learned work ethic and how to treat people very early on in my career working with him. And we also became friends. We raised our families. Our families are the same age. You know, we raised them together. And I can't say enough about he and his wife and his kids. And, you know, and I always, to this day, I credit being where I am today from, you know, his mentorship and his kindness. There were times where I needed somewhere to stay in Los Angeles to read for the next series and the next series. And they always welcomed me into their home and treated me like part of the family. And, you know, I'm incredibly indebted in that regard to him. And I have nothing but the most respect and admiration for him.
I wanted to ask you, because I spent a lot, many, many years in Vancouver. So like you, I share a fondness for biking and cycling. How did...
Oh.
Yeah, and sadly I don't do enough of it here in Toronto, but how did you that sort of become to be part of your extracurricular routine? What was that appeal for you?
I hit a bit of a rough spot in my 30s. I was going through some things, some work things, some, you know, just personal stuff, and I sort of sat down with myself a little bit and said, you know, what are the things that do make you happy? What are the things that are big positives for you? And I had to sort of start thinking back and back and back. And it really got down to, you know, one of those key moments that you remember from your childhood where you felt, you know, free and you experienced autonomy and elation and those happy times. And for me, that was always out on my bicycle and being in nature, and those two combined together were like, well, that's an easy answer. I had experienced mountain biking on a project when I was a teenager in BC. I apologize, it's going to get a little loud here, but I had experienced that out on the UBC grounds with a friend. So I kind of thought back to that. Here I am running across the street. I sort of thought back to that, and I thought, well, why don't I get myself a bicycle and, you know, try to recapture some of that? And so I did, and it made the world of difference. I was being active. I was tinkering with bikes. I was out in nature. I was pushing myself physically, you know, progressing. You got your adrenaline, your endorphins, all that different stuff. And it was a magic bullet for me. It was like, wow, why haven't I been doing this a lot longer? I sort of put my last BMX bike away when I was a teenager and hadn't touched one since, you know, raising a family and working. So that's really what it is for me.
Is it true that you collect bikes? How many do you have?
Ooh, I think I have right now 3. But they're in constant rotation because the type of bikes that I buy, I use them for a year or two. And there's a strong resale market because, you know, they're not cheap anymore. They're carbon fiber, stuff like that. So I try to not beat them up too much and then put them back out there for sale for guys who, you know, want to dip into the market on a very high-end bike. But, you know, the downstroke of a brand new one is just too much. And I get that, you know, I did it in the beginning. I'm very fortunate to have a sponsor of sorts. I'm an ambassador for Norco Bikes, which I'm really excited about because it's a Canadian company. And, you know, a fabulous bunch of people. And, you know, that means a lot to me, supporting a Canadian company and especially in something that's, you know, means so much to me.
It's funny you mention it because my bike's a Norco, so...
Oh, well, then there you go. You're doing it right.
I appreciate your ambassadorship.
Awesome.
The film is Helmington. It comes out later this month. Do I have the exact release date here? The 18th, I do, if I'm correct. Tomorrow. Comes out tomorrow. Yannick Bisson, thanks so much for your time this afternoon.
Thanks for having me.
Alrighty, you have a good day now.
All right.
Cheers. That was my conversation with actor and director Yannick Besson. His new film, Helmington, in which he co-stars as Professor Freeborn, is out now. And season 13 of Murdoch Mysteries is now airing on CBC. That does it for me on today's show. Next week, I'll be featuring dancers Roberto Soria and Devin Snell. Thanks for listening, and I'll see you next time. Goodbye for now.
I just like to have a lot of sex.